Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out, 31st of August, 2021. Very happy to be back with you here on the show. Plenty for you here on the show, as we always do. We're going to be talking about elections in Somalia. Yet another election crisis there in less than a year. We're going to be talking about the terrible food in Maryland prisons and how it's gotten much worse during the pandemic. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we want to start with U.S. courts that issued a ruling yesterday very much in favor of clean water. The federal judge yesterday threw out the Trump administration written rule regulating or allegedly regulating water in a range of wetlands and smaller water resources, a rule that had colloquially become known as the Dirty Water Rule because it had thrown out previous rules written in the 1980s and tightened in the Obama administration designed to keep these various water sources at least relatively clean. As the Washington Post stated, quote, U.S. District Judge Rosemary Marquez wrote that Trump officials committed serious errors while writing the regulation, finalized last year, and that leaving it in place could lead to, quote, serious environmental harm. The Post went on to further note that, quote, Marquez, a Barack Obama appointee, noted that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which oversees permits to dredge and fill waterways under federal jurisdiction, determined that three-quarters of the water bodies it reviewed over a nearly 10-month period did not qualify for federal protection under the new rule. Federal agencies identified 333 projects that would have required a review under the Obama rule, she added, that's the judge, but did not merit one under the Trump standards. That includes, by the way, a strip mining operation down in Georgia. So as you can see, the Trump rule had heavily narrowed federal oversight over a huge amount of the nation's waterways. As Earth Justice, a climate advocacy group, put it, quote, the Dirty Water Rule would negatively affect, their writing, of course, right before it came, would negatively affect nearly one in every five streams, more than half of all wetlands and many other lakes, ponds, and other waters. The Dirty Water Rule negatively affecting one in every five streams, more than half of all wetlands and many other lakes, ponds, and other waters. New Mexico would have lost protections on 66% of its streams, and California 34%, just to give you an example of how expansive it was. Now, it may be somewhat obvious how important the overall issue is, but it is worth stating in more detail. Wetlands, which are very rarely focused on, for instance, actually play a very important role in the ecology of the landscape. Wetlands provide essential physical, chemical, biological functions that maintain the integrity of the surrounding environment. They stabilize the water supply, lessening the extreme effects of flood, drought, and fire. Sounds pretty important these days. Also, one of the most important functions of wetlands is they help maintain and improve the quality of water, actually. They're able to help remove sediment, you know, and also pollutants and add nutrients into surface water. And wetlands are also critical to the food chain. And a lot of animals use wetlands for a portion of their life cycle. It's also a spawning and nursery ground for a lot of smaller and younger fish, helping them avoid predators. Also keeps the cycle of life going there. And certainly, wetland trees and shrubs also help maintain cooler water temperatures for cold water species, which of course could die out without them. The various small streams and headwaters that are at stake here are also crucial for providing water in arid areas and also maintaining water flows and replenishing various downstream sources. So removing many of these areas from real protections obviously would create a lot of dangers. To give you a sense, you could think about the St. Louis River in northern Minnesota. It's a major tributary for Lake Superior. It's one of the areas that is at issue in terms of losing quite a bit of its coverage under the Trump rule, and that regains it to some degree now, but we'll get to that. That St. Louis River originates in wetlands in the northern part of Minnesota, and that same area is also home to massive mining deposits, in particular sulfide mines that create sulfuric acid as a byproduct and cause something known as acid mine drainage. Yes, that is as bad as it sounds, because this acid is leaching into nearby waters, and it can cause all sorts of significant damage, destroying crops of all types, including wild rice crops, which are big in that area and very important for the indigenous nations in the broader region. The mines also cause a highly toxic mercury dust to settle over the surrounding landscape. So everything in these wetlands is just coated by mercury dust, which sends that toxic poison into the food chain of fish, and since fish are in the food chain of humans, into the human bloodstream. Not a small thing, mercury is very poisonous, and one very notable fact about that is babies in the womb can suffer brain damage if they're exposed to too much mercury. So all in all, you get a sense of why having strong monitoring over wetlands and other smaller waterways is crucial. The rules will now revert to the pre-Obama standards, and the process of writing a new rule will have to begin again. Likely the EPA will consider something similar to the Obama-era rules, but there will be all sorts of legal challenges from mining companies, as you might expect, but also from huge factory farms who often want to destroy wetlands in order to expand their massive enterprises. So undoubtedly, the court battles over keeping water clean will continue. But for now, this is certainly a big win in terms of making sure the various sources of water that sustain life can avoid being choked with poison. Food cost in U.S. prisons nationwide topped $2.1 billion. That money is often received by contractors hired by states to serve that same food. Commissary revenues. People buy food as well as other things from commissaries nationwide in the U.S. prison system. $1.6 billion in revenue. So the business of providing food to prisoners is big business. But the food itself is often quite substandard and outright unsanitary. Recently, the Maryland Food and Prison Abolition Project released a study interviewing people in Maryland's system of mass incarceration about the quality of food during the pandemic. And it's not like it was good before, but by all accounts, it's gotten much worse. Because of COVID-related, or at least alleged COVID-related lockdowns for every prisoner, it meant that incarcerated people were forced to eat every meal either alone in a cell or in a crowded dormitory. And many related to researchers, they were actually forced to sit on the toilet in order to be able to eat. Many also reported serious issues with hunger because of irregularly served meals, schedules like breakfast at 4 a.m., lunch at 10 a.m., and dinner at 4:30 p.m. One incarcerated person, Jackie, told researchers, quote, "They were just locking people in a cage and feeding them slop," end quote, detailing how food that was in bags and on trays ended up sloshing altogether, often making meals essentially inedible. There are also reports at various places of meal trays covered with peeled off paint chips. There's also a significant reduction all across the system of whatever fresh fruits and vegetables that have been available before. And all sorts of health impacts were noted by prisoners as a result of the lack of dietary care provided by the correctional facility and its contractors, from developing diabetes and ulcers to losing weight due to lack of food or gaining weight due to bad foods with few nutrients. Some even contracted hepatitis B from ingesting food that had come into contact with fecal matter. In Maryland prisons, a company called Keefe Group, it's owned by a private equity firm, HIG Capital, runs all the commissaries. These are little stores where people can buy essentials and also some food. It became even more critical of a lifeline to something besides prison food during the pandemic for those who were incarcerated. 87% of those surveyed detailed relying heavily on the commissary. What did Keefe Group do? Well, they increased prices 10 to 40% during the pandemic. Now, of course, many prisoners already struggle to pay for commissary, but with a lot of the work details slowed down, Keefe Group said, no problem. They rolled out an online payment option to make it easier to extort the families of prisoners who are desperate to find a way to help their incarcerated loved ones obtain a little something to eat that they found halfway decent. So paying these just gouging prices to Keefe Group. People didn't take it lying down, though, and the report details hunger strikes, court cases, and other forms of resistance that have been engaged in and are being engaged in consistently to push back. The sad part is these types of stories are par for the course in the U.S. prison system, and just another glimpse into the pervasive brutality and abuses of the so-called criminal justice system. Somalia's parliamentary elections, which took months to get off the ground earlier this year, have now run into another roadblock as a group of opposition candidates rejected the rules of the process. The issue at stake is who approves the parliamentary lists for the lower house, which are then voted on in an indirect election process. There are five major clans in Somalia, which hold quite a bit of power in the country. Previously, the election system set up after the U.S.-backed regime change in the country in 2007, which unleashed the current civil war that's been raging ever since. These clan leaders essentially just got together and picked the various government officials. There are also other power centers, though, the heads of the various federal states and also the presidency in and of itself in particular. The destabilization backed by the United States and other Western nations and carried out mainly by Ethiopia. At that point, by the way, Ethiopia was ruled by the rebel forces in Ethiopia now, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. But of course, this destabilizing regime change operation, the U.S., Ethiopia, was quickly backed by the AU, the African Union, and was allegedly supposed to bring freedom, democracy, stability, all the things these regime changes are always supposed to bring. So the fact that it really ended up just being a despotic lashup of powerful clan and government leaders was obviously not that, and there were always promises that this was a transitional setup that would lead to a one-person, one-vote elections. And the West, of course, in particular, you know, was always holding this out as we're going towards, you know, a great Western-style democracy. Now, of course, this has always been a bit of a pipe dream for a few reasons. I mean, one, of course, the powerful hate to give up their power. But two, huge swaths of the country are controlled by al-Shabaab, an Islamic group opposed to the government and waging an armed insurgency. The current president, who's colloquially known as Farmajo, has been saying since he came to power in 2017 that he was going to break the power of the clans and give everyone the right to vote for the parliament and president and establish a more centralized state. Ultimately, this did not happen. There's a lot of back and forth over what was going to happen. The president ultimately agreed with his opponents, mainly a group of former presidents and high officials with ties to important clan and regional leaders, and they agreed to have the clans approve parliamentary lists for both houses, then have clan-approved delegates vote for the MPs, then the MPs would vote for the next president. And this is all supposed to happen between August and October of this year. However, in the fall of 2020, this agreement broke down over the details of how it would be carried out, and in February of this year, Farmajo's term ended. He tried to stay in power and got the lower house of parliament to extend his term 2 years. And in his words, that was to help pave the way for one-person, one-vote elections after establishing more quote-unquote stability. His opponents, backed by the West, balked at that. It seemed like the two sides might break into armed conflict. The West didn't like Farmajo's moves because it was ultimately ripping the mask off of the so-called democratic government they claimed to be supporting, showing it to be what it is, essentially just a despotism of an elite leadership clique. Under pressure from the international community, Farmajo then backtracked ultimately, and the elections were slated to start in 60 days. And in fact, the elections for the upper house did in fact start taking place on August 10th. And that brings us to last week. The prime minister and the heads of the federal states said that the rules were changed for the lower house, that the candidates would be vetted by the state leaders, cutting the clan leaders out of an important part of the process. The opponents of the president feel this puts them in a weaker position and have now rejected going forward with the lower house elections, which also means a presidential election in jeopardy. So now things are in a stalemate, a worrisome situation because the last stalemate almost broke into open conflict. Somalia has been almost perpetually in a state of civil war since 1991. The only stable government for a few years, the Islamic Courts Union in the mid-2000s, was overthrown in a U.S.-backed regime change operation. And now the fruits of that operation, a weak, unstable government, is set to possibly drive the country even deeper into conflict by its collapse. Anyway, you cut it, Somalis are in a very tough position, facing even more devastation and displacement, all because the U.S. demands to be allowed to manipulate the whole world, whatever the cost. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.